The political world is becoming increasingly volatile and unpredictable, while at the same time having a profound impact on the lives of citizens across the globe. This is Polis Podcast, and I am Thomas Barton, the founder of Polis Analysis. Every week, I'll be in the virtual armchair with relevant experts from Polis teams to discuss the key developments shaping the political world. All we need is for you to join us on the virtual sofa. Hello and welcome to this week's Polis podcast episode. I'll be talking with Jay about sustainability and climate change related issues. So Jay, who's with me now, is an analyst at Polis Analysis. She focuses on climate change and humanitarian and international aid related topics. And she has a professional background in humanitarian work as well. So Jay, it's great to have you with me. And the first thing I wanted to ask you, just for the benefit of our listeners, is if you could provide a little bit of background in terms of what's going on when it comes to climate change, and crucially, what's going on when it comes to the policies that governments are trying to implement to tackle this issue, notably with the COP26 summit that's coming up. So if you could just provide a bit of background for our listeners, that would be fantastic.
Hi, Thomas. Great to be with you. We are at a very interesting point in history at the moment, I think, in terms of climate change. So on one hand, we definitely are seeing the impact of climate change globally in a much more kind of present, visible way. So we were seeing currently the floods in Germany. We're seeing the wildfires in the US. We saw the situation in Australia last year. And so I think it's much more tangible for people globally. Also, we're seeing a much higher rate, for example, heat-related deaths. This is a reflection of we're heading towards these, in terms of the planetary boundaries, which is the space we need. It's the safe space, which as humans, we need the planet to be at to function. And if we're within those planetary boundaries, the conditions on Earth are safe enough for us to live. Once we go beyond them towards tipping points, systems become more chaotic, not just more dangerous, but harder for us to predict. We're reaching these tipping points, particularly in areas such as climate change, ocean acidification, nitrogen and phosphorus impact in the environment. So what we're seeing with the impact of this kind of, not just scientifically reaching these tipping points, but kind of we can see these tipping points being reached in our day-to-day lives, is there's a lot more public pressure on governments to act. And what we're seeing, we've seen that a really significant shift in the past few years, and we've got the EU, Japan, Korea, UK, all saying that they're going to reach net zero by 2050. China's saying by 2060. US is starting to, a lot of those plans are not in legislation yet, but the US is being quite clear on their aims. So we're seeing this kind of shift in terms of governments, bigger governments acting. And it's also very much on the agenda in places like India as well. All of this is going to play into COP, which is the Conference of the Parties at the end of the year in Glasgow, which is run by under the UK, but with the partnership with Italy. A lot of people are saying this is kind of the most important action since Paris, because it's this point where we've realized that we have to stay within 1.5 degrees. Around the time of Paris and in the past, everyone was saying 1.5, 2 degrees is okay. But what we're seeing now is there's a massive impact, a massive difference between 1.5 and 2. And really this whole, a key aspect of that is this 2030 stuff people are probably starting to hear. So we're starting to hear like we have to have emissions by 2030, 2040 is not enough. For us to even get to net zero by 2050, by 2030, we really need to have that infrastructure on the way. So that's kind of one of really the key goals of Glasgow, is not just this 1.5 degree thing, in terms of mitigation, climate financing at $100 billion per year. And also there's some people are calling it the blue COP, because there's also a much greater emphasis on oceans in terms of food supply chains with fishing, also ocean acidification. So there's also this kind of oceanic element to COP, and also this biodiversity element, which we was not strong in previous UN deliberations.
Sure, that's really helpful, Jay. And I wonder if the reason why the ambition is increasing at COP26 compared to the Paris Climate Agreement that you just mentioned is because of the real tangible impacts that climate change is having on the lives of individuals. So citizens and voters are now expecting their elected representatives and their governments to take action. And you mentioned earlier on in your comments that actually, we're seeing, with the floods in Germany, for instance, the real sort of tangible impact of climate change. So I'm just wondering if you can sort of shed a bit of light in terms of what you think are the sort of real climate issues that are impacting individuals in their lives. So for instance, the impact on sort of more adverse weather, or the impact of rising temperatures, or the impact on air quality, for instance. I mean, if we use the UK as an example, given the UK, as you mentioned, is a host country for COP26, it's mm-hmm. been said by scientists that within the next decade, the UK can start regularly experiencing heat waves of 40 degrees. I mean, these are drastic changes in terms mm-hmm. of climate. So, do you mind just maybe explaining a little bit about what impact climate change really has on a citizen level?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you kind of break it down into three kind of areas, you've got kind of the disaster impact, the infrastructure shift impact, and also, I suppose, the existential side of things. So in terms of the disaster impact, it really depends where you are in the world as to what's hitting you. So in some countries, we're seeing much more serious wildfires or bushfires, as we call them in Australia. Higher temperatures, more months of the year. We saw this in Siberia. We're seeing this right now in the US, also last year in California. We know in the Australian bushfires, 3 billion animals died. So that's kind of the fire side of things. We're seeing the temperature rise in areas, low-lying areas such as the Netherlands, Bangladesh, the Pacific, which could reach a few, it depends on what you're looking at, but something between 10 centimeters, other predictions say several meters. These are quite large amounts, particularly for low-lying areas. Then you've got this element of greater impact of storms. So for example, coral, a significant percent of the world lives within 25 kilometers of a coral reef. And currently coral reefs take all of so much of the energy of the waves and protect us from the waves and storms hitting coasts. If these reefs die, we lose those barriers. And the final one you mentioned, the heat waves, is something we've really seen, particularly in New York recently. So we're also seeing snow in Brazil, a lot more snow in places like Brazil. So we're seeing that really extreme, that weather hitting extremely. We saw recently in Canada, it was 49 degrees or something, wasn't it?
Sure. These are all good examples, which I think our listeners can relate to in terms of how climate change is actually having a real impact. So given what COP26 and given what you mentioned earlier, that policymakers are looking to be more bold in their ambitions in tackling climate change, mm-hmm. just sticking to the 1.5 degrees rather than the 2 degrees in terms of temperature increases, looking at 100 billion of funding a year, what will be the impact, therefore, of government policy on citizens' lives? If we use the UK again as an example, the chairman of the National Infrastructure Commission yesterday came out and said that individuals in the UK can expect to see their bills go up by around £400 a year because of efforts towards decarbonizing the UK economy. And we know the UK government has already set out all sorts of ambitions, from phasing out petrol and diesel cars to phasing out gas boilers. I believe you cannot install a gas boiler in your home from 2028. So these are real measures that are being taken that will have a direct impact on people's lives. We've been talking about, you know, the government entering people's gas cupboards, if you want, boiler cupboards, and we're talking about increasing costs for individuals. Even for industry as well, it's going to be very expensive to ensure that industries are decarbonizing. I mean, even again, if we use the UK example, the chairman of the National Infrastructure Commission also talked about the fact that taxpayers will have to spend £400 million over the next decade to help industry decarbonize. So, I mean, there are some real material costs associated with government's responses to climate change. So, I mean, can you shed any light, Jay, in terms of what impact government policy will have on citizens' lives when it comes to trying to green our economies and make our societies more sustainable?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely your point about energy is really important, particularly in countries with high dependencies on either heating, as in the UK, or air conditioning, as in Southeast Asia, but also in terms of mobility for people. So in some cases, we're going to be seeing more bike lanes, more alternative forms of transport, greater investment in public transport. And that's going to be coupled with really this big push towards electric vehicles. The UK and California are kind of being key examples there. What it's going to be very interesting to see is with that shift towards electric cars, how much of that is going to be pushed onto the consumer and how much of it is going to be supported through infrastructure. So right now, for example, in the UK, there's a lot more electric car infrastructure in London and the surrounding areas than, say, I don't know, in the north or up in Scotland or down in Wales.
Sure.
And another point in terms of what we buy, in terms of our consumerism, there's a big push at the moment towards what's called the right to repairability, which is this idea that we should be able to reuse, maintain electronic goods much longer. And the UK and the EU have recently passed legislation around this, really focusing on white goods like dishwashers, microwaves, ovens. But there's a real push to shift that as well towards like smartphones and laptops. So I think it's also going to impact our consumer behavior in that sense as well.
No, absolutely. And I think, yeah, there's a really good examples again of demonstrating that this is going to have an impact on our listeners. It's that tangible in terms of government responses. But it's also because, and I think this is an important point to make, Jay, that actually individuals have a role to play. So we often talk about sort of the top-down approach in terms of government delivering policy solutions, but individuals can also have an impact in terms of their consumption. And we know that in terms of if we look at the food industry and food consumption, meat-based products like beef are responsible for a huge proportion of carbon emissions, whereas if you move towards more of a plant-based or fruit-based diet, emissions are suddenly reduced. So there is a role for citizens to play in helping reduce emissions. It's not just government policy that will solve this problem. But I think the elephant in the room, Jay, and I think the question that our listeners will have is what next? So you've really nicely set out the sort of climate change situation. You've demonstrated that it has a real impact on the lives of our citizens in terms of the impact of climate change, but also the impact of government responses to the issue. You've made that quite clear. So given COP26 is coming up, I think the question on people's minds will be, what's going to happen? I mean, will that summit lead to global action? And will governments come together from across the world and deliver an agreement that will deliver policies that will be ambitious and radical in tackling climate change? Or will world leaders fail to meet that test? Because I would argue that it's hugely difficult to get governments to come together and agree on a common way forward. If we look at the G7 summit, for instance, that was in Cornwall, world leaders in the G7 failed to agree a $100 billion package that would have helped developing countries decarbonize, for instance. So to put it bluntly, Jay, COP26, will it succeed or will it fail in your view?
I think you should look at There's a few different angles to look at it from, but essentially, Thomas, if you think, really the big players are on board now, most of them. You've got China on board, Korea, Japan, EU, UK, US. So you've got those big players on board. You've also got a lot of the poorest countries in the world on board. There's a huge amount of community activism and grassroots action, particularly around things like deforestation, precision agriculture in the Pacific and Africa, because they're already living this. Where that question mark is those middle countries. So countries, say, take countries like Turkey or Russia, who don't have clear policies on climate change yet. Poland are not really actively, directly, you know, making it their priority if you look at their politics right now. You've got countries like Australia, which don't have clear policies and are still very heavily dependent on carbon. So even though those countries are not like the biggest players, there's so many of the countries in that kind of middle bracket that they're really an important player. And the other thing I think we can see, particularly with social media now, is every time these crises happen, it has a really big impact globally. I think things such as the fires in the Amazon, the fires in Siberia and Australia had a big impact mentally on people. So if the week that COP is happening, there's floods in Belgium and, I don't know, more fires in the US, it's going to be much harder for politicians from those countries to be at COP not acting if their countries are suffering. And so I think it's also the situation at the time of COP that's going to impact. And since we seem to be seeing a very like significant amount of natural disasters this year, it's reasonable to assume we're going to be experiencing some kind of natural disaster globally at the end of October.
Sure. I mean, that's a really excellent point that actually it will all depend on the environment in both senses of the word. So I suppose politicians, if they're in that conference in Glasgow at COP26, they'll find it extremely difficult to not deliver some radical solution to dealing with the issue if, as you say, we see more cases of the impact of climate change, which ultimately impacts the lives of of citizens. But I wonder if economies in Europe, for instance, have recognized that fundamentally they can do their bit to decarbonize their economies. But fundamentally, you need that international agreement, right? So with the UK, you know, we've cited some examples of where, you know, the UK as the host country of COP26 has been setting out its policy agenda for helping make its economy more sustainable. But at the same time, the UK is responsible for less than 1% of global carbon emissions. And actually, it's other countries like the US, like China, that really need to come together and forge an agreement if we are actually to tackle this crisis. So I suppose, do you think that world leaders are aware that fundamentally they can't tackle this problem unless they act together? Or do you think that they will just keep sort of failing to agree as they did in the G7 to more ambitious global action, and they'll instead sort of, you know, each country will sort of set its own national plan for dealing with climate change?
We're at this strange point, aren't we, where the science, if anyone remembers the Montreal Protocol, when that happened with the, in terms of the ozone layer, the science was quite clear there. This is the problem here, this needs to be done here to fix that. Up until this point in climate change, we haven't really had such clear scientific evidence, which you can kind of, an ordinary person can look at and see. The new science around the planetary boundaries, and what we speak of with the planetary boundaries we spoke about before in terms of ocean acidification, biodiversity, land use change, is really much clearer evidentially for people to understand and work from. So we've got a much clearer scientific base that we're all working with. We're all on the same page more scientifically. But we are also seeing with what we speak about at Polis, with misinformation, a huge reaction to that reality. if we look at the amount of Republicans in the US, there's Republicans this week suggesting that we should learn to live with climate change, that we shouldn't address it. And that's not an isolated case. So it's not really a question now of is the science there or not in a clear way. It's a question now of how much of the population globally engages with and acknowledges that science.
That's an excellent point. Jay, that's an excellent point to wrap up with, because as you say, there's consensus on the science. The climate change skepticism has massively reduced in recent years in terms of its existence and its impact. I suppose where the differences are emerging is in terms of the government's responses to dealing with that climate challenge. But ultimately, we'll have to wait and see what happens in November in Glasgow with COP26. And I'm sure you'll be writing analysis for our newsletter subscribers in the meantime, where we can try and anticipate what we can expect to unfold at that conference, and whether the impact of climate change, which we've both discussed, really has an impact on the citizen level, will fundamentally be addressed by policymakers, and whether global leaders will rise to the challenge. But thanks so much, Jay, for being with me today. And next week, I will be speaking to Adam, who is our lead editor at Polis Analysis. And we'll actually be moving into an interesting continent. We'll be looking at developments in Africa, specifically looking at the conflict in Ethiopia. So until then, stay well and stay safe. And thanks so much, Jay, for being with me.
All right, thank you so much, Thomas. Have a good day.
We hope you enjoyed this Polis podcast episode. At Polis Analysis, we are fully devoted to helping individuals better navigate the political world. So we would love to hear your thoughts, and please do share any suggestions you may have for future Polis podcast episodes. Follow the Polis podcast channel on Spotify to access our weekly episodes. And if you want to better navigate the political world with accessible, fact-based and impartial analysis of global politics, then sign up to our free newsletter at www.polisanalysis.com. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.